This is Inside Open Wheel with your host, Jeremy Scott.
From the Trackon Multimedia Studios just outside of Chicago, this is Inside Open Wheel. Hello, everybody. I'm Jeremy Scott. Hopefully, you had a good St. Patrick's Day, enjoyed plenty of corned beef, or like one of mine and Charlie's best friends did, enjoyed seafood. Of course, you know, to each their own, nonetheless. Charlie joins me here in just a little bit, but first I want to tell you what's going on today's show. USF 2000 driver Miles Rowe joins us. He is the driver, the number 99 Force Indy Tatus in USF 2000. We'll talk about how he became to be and how he's balancing school and racing at the same time. Then Charlie joins us with John Oriovitz. He has a new book coming out and one that I'm stupid excited about. So excited, I actually pre-bought it, which is something I hardly ever do. I've done for one other book, and it wasn't a guest that's been on our show as well. Also, Adam Blocker, the recent winner of the Coca-Cola of Kokomo Bottling Company Indy Elite Series. He stops by to talk about his win, and, you know, we talked about him early in the season, and you'll find out why as well. Also, Charlie and I talk about the new IndyCar iRacing Challenge that just ended not too long ago after this recording. So, as always, you can call us on our Google voicemail at 815-714-9260. Email us insideopenwheel@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at InsideOpenWheel. Now, Charlie, normally this news and notes is usually reserved for Open Wheel news, but really there's not too much in the way of Open Wheel news right now. Next week's going to be a very heavy F4 FR Americas preview show. We'll talk about that later on, but it's been pretty light in the Open Wheel world, and it's kind of nice because we can focus on some stuff that may affect the Open Wheel world here in about a month or so.
No driver signings to talk about?
Oh, there's plenty of drivers. They've actually tapered off, but or they've happened and we don't know about it, so. So I figured we would talk about a couple of things that kind of caught my eye.
I'm intrigued. What are they?
So this comes from autosport.com, and the title is F1 planning free or discounted tickets to make races more accessible, written by Luke Smith. The lead is Formula One is planning to make tickets available to those within local communities of races and from underprivileged backgrounds at a discounted rate or free to improve accessibility. And this is all part of their We Race as One program. I think it's interesting because a lot of these countries that have F1, like the United States, they put F1 behind a paywall for most races or all races. And you still have fans who they like F1, but they can't access it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, Formula One sort of has a unique place in the world of motorsport, for better and for worse. Mm-hmm. I think for worse is that, you know, I mean, how much is an IndyCar ticket? Like $60 or so for a weekend? Something like that?
I would say $60 for race day. Case in point, Barber Motorsports Park, which is less than a month away, by the way, kind of frightening to think about. They're only doing general admission throughout the facility. And that's part of the way to kind of limit capacity due to COVID. And I think I saw it's $55 for an adult to get in on Sunday.
So, okay. So, that's kind of the baseline for going to a pro race in the US, but Formula One tickets, they start around like a couple $100.
Yes.
And then they go up from there. So, you know, if you want to travel, you know, the all the hotels are full and they jack up their rates and you got to eat out and all this and that. So going to a Formula One race is very expensive. And so, yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the particulars of this deal, but yeah, I mean, lowering ticket prices, I think, is a good thing. I would also file this under things that never would have happened under Bernie Ecclestone.
Of course not.
So, it sounds pretty good to me.
So I was mistaken. I was $10 off. I apologize to Barber Motorsports Park. It's actually $45 to get in on a Sunday, a race day. $20 for Friday, $35 for Saturday. That's a good deal, by the way, because you get not only get the NTT IndyCar Series. This is on Sunday, but you get the whole road to Indy. I think you also get. Let me look, but I think all the other the non Let me see here. Event info, event schedule. Okay, here we go. So Sunday, for $45, you get the second Indy Pro Race, Porsche Sprint Challenge, and Indy Lights Race in the NTT IndyCar Series. That's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that also kind of goes to what I've said before. Anytime Pocono comes up,
yeah,
is that you pay, and I forget how much it costs, but you go when there's like a USAC go kart race in the parking lot, and then the IndyCar race, and then like 3 hours of nothing in between. So yeah, it's a pretty good deal. I think I also should confess I haven't bought tickets to an IndyCar race in a very long time because. My status or my connections as a Pro Mazda alumni sort of get me in for free. So
the last time I bought tickets was for the last Indy 500 held with fans.
Yes. But that's also, you know, if you're talking about ticket prices, that's also another exception. I'm sure the Indy 500 is priced much differently than any other race.
It is, yeah. I mean, and you like me, I can find ways to get into races for free. That's, you know, that's not a big deal.
Except for, I think I would have a lot of trouble getting into Indy for free.
We'll see about that.
For me, most of my connections are in the lower series.
Yeah. So, to put it in perspective, I think, you know, we can use the Indy 500 as a baseline for ticket prices closest to F1. So, in the Northeast Vista, which is Turn 3, tickets there are going for $113. Same goes for the Northwest Vista. Where Emily and that's, I... Go ahead.
Let's see. That's still less than Formula One.
It still is.
Take a look right now while we talk.
Well, we're... You remember... God, what was it? 08 when you sold me tickets to the 500? Because you couldn't go for some reason?
I do remember that.
Yeah. So that's where Emily and I sat last year, or 2 years ago. Those are going for $85 now.
Mm-hmm. So they haven't really gone up that much.
No, they haven't. And then the paddock seats, which are on driver's right of the front straightaway, are home for $120. What? $120? $125? How is that more expensive? I don't get that.
Maybe you're in the shade?
Yeah. I guess I would take the race, you know, seeing more action on the track over seeing over getting shade, but that's just me.
Yeah, I've never really understood people that sit in the grandstands along the straightaway. There's really not much to see.
You get the screen and you get pit road. For some people, they like watching the action on pit road. I understand that. I get that.
Pit road, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, that I'm fine with. But man, $125 sitting in paddock. And of course, as usual, E stand that's sold out. If there were any place I would want to sit with shade, it'd be E stand. Those are fantastic seats.
I'm looking at ticket. Prices for the British Grand Prix.
Okay.
Paddock Club is €4,479. which I think is interesting is that for me to take my Formula 1600 car up to Canada and race it in the Grand Prix Support Series and then go back home. Is like probably I would say ballpark $3,500, $4,000.
Yeah.
So it's still cheaper than the Paddock Club.
Yeah.
Like significantly cheaper.
So, F1 does not even have Monaco tickets on sale yet. Because that's
yeah, I think, who knows what the European restrictions are going to be. So,
yeah.
They're probably all just kind of sitting on their hands.
Yeah. So,
but I'm looking at the ticket, the user interface for buying tickets at the British Grand Prix.
Uh-huh.
And there's a filter here. Okay, well, you know what? That's useless. Never mind. The only things that are on sale right now are the Paddock Club tickets, what I can see.
And COTA is only letting you deposit, place a deposit down for U.S. Grand Prix tickets. So we really can't, you know, gauge what that is.
Unless we want to get into the Wayback Machine, but I don't really want to do that.
I don't feel like doing that. Hey, we can get media accreditation too, so maybe we can get to an F1 race for cheap-ish.
Mm.
That's a thought. So if anybody wants to sponsor us, insideopenwheel@gmail.com, we'll gladly take your money and go have some fun down in Austin. Another story I want to touch on real quick first came from Bob Pockris. He tweeted out on March 16th, NASCAR will use COVID-sniffing dogs at the garage entrance in Atlanta. Everyone who goes in the garage will be checked. NASCAR says the use of the dogs is as effective as a PCR test, which I find is interesting.
Yes, I would say COVID-sniffing dogs with big air quotes.
Dun, dun, dun. But, you know, here's what I find interesting about it. You know, if it's as effective as a PCR test, why are we not doing that in like airports and all that? But I do think it is a more effective, way of finding out if you have COVID, especially at a spectator event like that, than using an infrared, thermometer.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, maybe they are using it at airports and we just don't know about it.
Right.
Well, I don't pay that much attention to the news.
I haven't been in an airport in a while.
It could very easily have slipped by me. But so what happens? Like, I guess the dog kind of like walks over towards someone and sits down next to them or something, or gives some signal, and the cop goes up and says, "Hey, you have COVID. Go home."
I would imagine so. You know, they probably pull them out. You know, pull them out of a line and be like, you know. Or the dog, you know, we have a dog and it showed us a sign that you may have COVID and probably give him a PCR test, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, that's probably a...
Yeah, because like practical. Anything, it's probably just going to, you know, it might be a false positive, you know, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably correct.
That's
reasonable.
But no, I think it's interesting because, you know, if that works in Atlanta, we know that, you know, stuff that's happened in the early part of the season with NASCAR, that those policies have been implemented by IndyCar. So I would not be the least bit surprised if we start to see those COVID sniffing dogs at, you know, IndyCar events where we do have spectators at.
Yeah, it would. Yeah, absolutely.
So, because, yeah, you've got... you've got Barber, and you go to St. Petersburg. Almost at Sebring. What the hell was I thinking? By the way, Sebring's this weekend. There are some IndyCar drivers in the 12 hours of Sebring. We do know that Sebastian Bourdais is running. Simon Pagenaud is going to be running with Jimmy Johnson in the 48. Basically, the 48 is not the team to the 5. I would get strangled if I said that. The 48 is running with the Action Express 31. Scott Dixon is in the 01 Chip Ganassi Cadillac. So there's a fair amount of IndyCar talent in the IMSA WeatherTech Series this weekend. Also, don't forget that Vassar Sullivan Racing is running the Lexus with some IndyCar stars there as well. Back to what we're talking about with the COVID, I would not be surprised that if this works at Atlanta, that we see this implemented at not only more races, but at more sporting events, especially with now a lot of sporting events opening up with fans. Baseball is going to have fans at most of their events. And with the vaccine rollout too, you know? So,
that's all going to help. Like you said, airports as well, pretty much anywhere where people are starting to congregate.
Yeah, because, you know, here's the thing. Yes, COVID is dangerous, but at some point we've got to open back up. And I think that a lot of these governments are doing it safely. They're doing it smart. You know, they're poking needles in people's arms, that, you know, to get rid of, you know, to prevent COVID. So.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that it seems like things, I think I was just talking to my girlfriend earlier, I think that we're through the worst of it, and from now throughout the rest of the year, I think things are just going to start getting better and better.
And we're seeing blips here and there, and that's going to happen. But I don't disagree. I think, you know, we're fine. You know, I think we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not a freight train coming at us at 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty optimistic that by the end of summer, maybe by October, that. Things will, you know, maybe we will still be wearing masks when we're indoors, but I think pretty much everything will be open. Hopefully, you know, indoor stadiums will have fans in again at near full capacity, if not full capacity. And yeah, so I think that, you know, the next several months, we're going to start to feel some relief.
And I think by this time next year, hopefully we will be rid of the masks, which...
Yeah, I hope so. I think I think by the time, you know, Christmas comes around, things will be pretty much back to normal.
Yeah. And hopefully. And yeah, I would love to see it back to normal. All right, Charlie, hang tight. I'm going to let you step aside for a little bit. Coming up next, I talk with Miles Rowe, the USF 2000 driver with Force Indy next.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
And we're joined by the driver who will be piloting the number 99 Force Indy Tatus in USF 2000. It's Miles Rowe. Miles, I know you've been busy these past couple of months between testing and schooling and all that, but thanks for taking some time to sit down with us. Welcome aboard.
No, of course. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure, and it's wonderful to talk to you again, Jeremy.
It's great to have you back on. Let's talk about where you've been, what your testing schedule looks like, and how you're getting ready for the first race of the season in about a month from now.
Yeah, we've been making a couple of trips down to Florida, mostly at Sebring International Raceway, also at Homestead Miami Speedway one time. Just getting comfortable in the car. I've been, when I last went into Formula Cars about 3 years ago, I only did 3 weekends. So a big thing to prepare for this season was just about comfort. So running laps, running race stints mainly, just getting comfortable with getting my consistency where it needs to be, and making sure I can feel the car do exactly what it's supposed to be doing everywhere on the track. Sebring's been a big help, especially since I've never been to any street courses, which there are two on the calendar this year at Toronto and also at St. Petersburg. So Sebring's really bumpy, so it'll really help me adjust to those street course situations that I've never been involved in. But yeah, that's been the whole goal for this pre-race testing season.
It's amazing how bumpy Sebring is because, first of all, you don't see the normal free saw cycle like you would at a Toronto. And not to mention, too, it's in the middle of Florida. So, you know, how much difference do you think that can make in, you know, the pavement itself?
Yeah, the temperatures definitely will be a little different. I think, although it was in the winter, so it's really hard to say right now. I also don't know how the weather is going to affect the street circuits, especially with, you know, extra grip, you know, extra marbles on the track. But I think you could say it'll be slightly similar since it was in the winter in Florida. It wasn't too absurdly hot. So it was able to be close to, like, I think where the race temperatures will be for most of the season at the courses.
Yeah, especially with you know, Toronto and St. Petersburg, you know, it's going to be about the same, like you said. But nonetheless, it's got to be great knowing that not only you're one of the drivers who is going to be watched a lot in USF 2000, but at the same time, it's got to be a little strange to know that your first season is going to be very watched under the close full eye.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that, but I'm the kind of person who tries to take each step at a time and not focus too much on circumstances I can't control. So, of course, there'll be eyes, but what I plan to do is just come at the race weekends at, like, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, focus on what I have to do Friday in practice, what I have to do in qualifying and in the race, and take it for what it is, because that's all I can do. And my goal is just to progress as much as I can with every minute, every hour, every day it comes. And there could be 1, 2, 2 million, 7 billion, whatever, however many people watching me, but I'm going to do what I've always was going to do at that time. And as long as I learn from my mistakes and learn from my accomplishments and progress the way that I should be, that's just the goal here, and that's what I'm going to do.
Well, it helps too because not only do you have a mentorship with Team Penske, but a driver in Team Penske who really was instrumental into getting where you're at is that of Will Power. So that's got to help that you guys are kind of under the same garage too.
Yeah, the Penske team, they've had a few guys been helping mentor the whole team, including me. And it's been good. It's been good getting me, first of all, back on my feet, very smoothly and then progressing in the way that I need to gain some a little of experience that I need before I get into the season. Will has helped me like be able to get in the right mindset and everything, but you can say it's like we're in the same garage, but we don't do any data or anything right. like that. He does his races, I do mine, but it is helpful to hear his words every now and then to know the right mindset and just know how I should be thinking. But yeah, the Penske boys have definitely been helping. You could say like mentor me appropriately for what I need to do this season.
And of course, having someone like Rod Reed be the team principal, that's got to be really helpful as well.
Oh yeah, Rod, it's a blessing to work with Rod. He's very open-minded, and he's a great gentleman to be able to converse with. And you could tell him anything, and he'll tell you exactly what needs to be done, and he'll try to understand everything that's coming from you, and not he won't take anything wrong. He'll take it the way it needs to be because he's very open and trying to learn what the driver has to say, what the driver really is thinking and where he's coming from. Not just for the driver, but for the team in general. So he's a great listener and he loves to do the most he can to help advance the team for whatever they need. He'll listen and whatever we need, he'll do his best to get it done. So yeah, it's great working with Rob.
Miles Rowe joins us on Inside Open Wheel. He's going to be in the number 99 Force Indy Tatus in USF 2000. When you're off the track, you're also a junior at Pace University studying film and screen studies. So at least you're in the good part of the media where I can say, just keep going with that to stay away from radio. But nonetheless, what's that been like balancing your school studies with your on-track studies?
It's been a little tricky, but it's also been very nice to do at the same time. Tricky in the sense where you obviously have the midterms and the finals. I just had a midterm week last week and that kind of killed me. So like days or weeks like that where you have an excess amount of work, obviously like it's a give and take. So sometimes for the education, you would have to maybe dial it back for a day or two on the racing education. Which isn't a negative. It's a positive to have that sort of balance to be able to come away from something and go into something else and learn in that. And you could also take a lot of lessons out of that other subject that you're in and bring it in to the subject that you once were in. So things that I learn in film and photography about myself, I can take into myself in racing. For example, if we're talking about something in film class or photo class about, let's say, a photograph or film that has some sort of emotion or it provokes some sort of emotion within myself. From whatever I learned from that piece, I could take that emotion into my racing, whether it's how I drive a line or how I drive behind opponent and how I feel and how I can kind of manipulate that feeling towards the same kind of emotion I was getting out of the piece in the film or photograph, sort of a thing. There's a lot of parallels that can be taken from it if you're willing to be open and really analyze the whole situation you're in. So what I say about it is it's just about having the appropriate balance. And I think I'm still learning to have the balance at all times, but it's definitely a privilege and a pleasure to be able to see myself grow in that way and controlling that balance. And relating, comparing and contrasting like the similarities and differences between film and photographs and emotion and with racing itself as well.
Well, it doesn't hurt either that you also have great subjects with, you know, cars, scenery, things that you don't normally get to see in the real world, but really everything's a real world when it comes to motorsports. But things you don't see in the normal world, like, you know, if you need to go use, you know, like New York City, for example, as a backdrop. You have more of a unique approach that you could take to motorsports.
Exactly. It's a lot of vision involved in it. And just like in motorsports, where half of what you need to do is have great vision and see the line, see where the car needs to be. There's a lot of different things that you can see or use, for instance, reference points or whatever, to help gain a little advantage over the field. So yeah, the same thing with, with film, there's certain things that you could visually see for a photograph, for a cinematic piece, that maybe someone else won't see, that will be tailored just to you, and it'll give you an edge on whatever competition or whatever your goal is in creating that piece. Yes.
Now, obviously, with running carts, a lot of your experiences on road courses, you have at least one oval this year at Lucas Oil Raceway. Have you been able to hop in like a simulator, like iRacing, and, you know, get a feel for ovals? I mean, are you guys looking forward to testing at Lucas Oil Raceway sometime down the line this year?
Yeah, I've been able to get into the sim a few times and practice a little bit on the ovals. If I'm not mistaken, I don't think iRacing has Lucas Oil on its sim, but I've definitely been running the ovals on iRacing a little bit, especially around cars, to, first of all, to get used to just, you know, spatial awareness in the car. I mean, I think an oval on the sim is the best place to do that, to be able to get your spatial awareness in the car. So I've been doing that a lot, and also getting a feel for how to just drive the car at the limit, just through the corner, because that's what the oval is, really, just the maximum load you can take in the car through the corner, and also the exit speeds you attain from that as well. So learning how to use that properly, learning what's wrong, what's right. Yeah, I've been doing a lot of sim work with that. And yeah, there might be a test in the future at Lucas Oil that's still up for debate, but it's definitely in the cards, I'd say. But it would be very good, because I have not had any running in an oval. I think the only thing I've done in the actual world on an oval was maybe one time in a go-kart for like 5 laps. I think Newcastle has like this little oval track. Mm-hmm. Newcastle Motorsports Park has this little oval ring on the side of the track, and I went on there like for 5 laps, and that was about it. Well, so yeah, it'll definitely be good for us to have a test at Lucas Oil or any oval. First of all, it'll just get me used to really being at the maximum, like, grip and load of the car more constantly, and more truly. And it'll just be great to do that before, you know, going out there for the first time with loads of cars, around me on track. And safety is obviously a priority.
Well, not to mention, too, if you're practicing on iRacing, you don't necessarily have to worry about bending up equipment. You know, if you hit the, you know, hit the wall, bend up a wing, and you just hit the reset button. But yeah, you know, you just got to get used to it in real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the sim's definitely more forgivable, but it's definitely good to think about whether that should be the opportunity, whether that opportunity should be taken, because safety is definitely a priority when it comes to racing in the real world, especially when you're around multiple people, especially also since I'm pretty sure this USF season is going to be one of the biggest that they had so far. So yeah, that's definitely in the cards for us.
Yeah, I'm excited. The car counts could be really good. We're going to get a better look at that at spring training, April 4th to the 6th at Barber Motorsports Park. What track are you looking forward to the most this season in USF 2000?
There's a few. The tracks that I'm looking forward to the most in terms of just all around spectacle are Toronto, especially because that's up in Canada and it's right in the center of the city practically. So I'm a big city guy. So just, and I, like I said, I've never driven on a street course. So it'd be really fun to just be able to be in that environment and do that. Same thing with St. Petersburg as well. But I'm also like, I'm really looking forward to Barber because I grew up, before I even got my own kart, when I was racing concession carts for a time, I grew up at Atlanta Motorsports Park doing that. And Atlanta Motorsports Park is one of the most elevated kart tracks you could drive on. So I grew up learning how to drive with elevation, and I know Barber's is a roller coaster. So I'm really excited to see how I do at that course, learning how to drive through the elevations with the USF 17. That I'm very excited for, because I love driving on elevated tracks. I think that's definitely a strong suit for me.
Yeah, the kart track at Atlanta is one of my that's one of the tracks I need to get to. I keep seeing it on pictures and videos. It's like, I got to get out there. But being a guy from the Chicagoland area, I will say this: Toronto is one of my all-time favorite cities. It is a beautiful city. I love the street course around there. I think you're going to enjoy it. That about wraps up for this segment, Miles. So for, if fans want to watch how your progress is going, how could they follow you on social media?
Yeah, you could follow me on at Miles Rowe Racing on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook as well. You could also follow Force Indy at Force Indy 99 on Instagram, and also on their website at Force Indy. And yeah, that's how you can find us, on the links on the web for sure. And you can follow our progress and how we develop throughout the year.
Fantastic. Miles Rowe, we'll catch up later in the season. Thanks, man. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.
Coming up next on Inside Open Wheel, Charlie and I sit down with John Oriovitz. He has a new book coming out, and I'll say this, it's a book that's long overdue.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, Charlie Ante joins me. Charlie, you just got off an iRace. We'll talk more about Detroit. I'm proud of you, though, for Detroit, and we'll find out why here shortly. And Charlie is joining us, but also joining us is someone who I've known for years in the sport, working the sport since I really started. He was a columnist for IndyCar, and now he does stuff for IMSA, but he's got a new book coming out in May, May 30th to be precise, and if you're an open wheel racing fan, you know why that date sounds familiar. John Oriovitz joins us on Inside Open Wheel. John, welcome aboard. I am so excited about this new book you have coming out.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say, Jeremy, and hello, Charlie.
Hello.
It's a, you know, honestly, it's the culmination of a life of research for me. So it's really gratifying to see it come to the light of day, especially somebody's pointed out it's the 25-year anniversary of the infamous 1996, you know, the day of infamy.
Yeah,
it wasn't May 30th. It was May 26th, 1996. But of course, that was the day of the dueling 500s when Kart ran the U.S. 500. Head-to-head on the same day as the Indianapolis 500, and I think it might be the day the karma turned.
Exactly. Indy Split is the book. I will say this. We have a picture of the book cover on both our Facebook and our Twitter pages, but being a traffic reporter for Indianapolis, I kind of found it funny that the first picture that came up was the ever-elusive North Split, but that's for another day. This has been a book that I think needed to be written years ago. What was your breaking point to finally realize it's time to release this?
Being unemployed.
That's a good reason.
Honestly, ESPN in early 2017 decided they were going to stop providing dedicated coverage to motorsports. Mm-hmm. And with unfortunate timing, after believing that my contract was going to be renewed, it wasn't. And it left me in a really bad position, you know, a month before the season. Dropped by my employer. And they were merciless with Bob Pockris as well. Bob Pockris had 1 year left on his contract, but at least they had the courtesy of giving him several months notice that they were going to not renew him. Anyway, I tried to chart a new path in 2017 and figure out what to do. And I started doing this book. I thought, you know, I've been doing the research, honestly, since I was a kid, since I started going to the Indy 500 when I was 13 years old. And I was fascinated by the split, the original Kart USAC split in 1978-79. And, you know, I realized that I'd been paying attention to it all my life. And of course, the second part of it, I was in it as a professional, whether I was working for a team as a PR person or as a journalist. And I just started documenting it. And I ran into my old friend, Bruce McCaw at Sonoma in 2017. And I said, hey, Bruce, we've had this book about PacWest that's been on my back burner for a long time. And I was in position to finish it up. I said, I've got this other idea. And Bruce was kind enough to get on board and support the project. And we got to a point earlier this year where we started looking for a publisher, and Octane Press out of Austin, Texas was interested. A niche publisher of automotive and racing books and calendars and such. And it's been fast-tracked, and it's neat to see it. First of all, I mean, after doing the PacWest book pretty much independently and selling them off my website and, you know, shipping them from home here, if anybody's interested, go to johnoriovitz.com and buy a PacWest book. It's been great working with a team of people you know, who are out there promoting it. And it's really exciting. I mean, it's a quote unquote real book. It's going to be in bookstores and on Amazon, things like that. And what's been especially neat is that yesterday, excuse me while I push my cat away here, got a new habit of sitting on my laptop.
Oh, they all do that after a while.
Not my laptop, but my laptop computer, I should say. Anyway, it suddenly became realistic to get it out by May. And of course, May is the best time to have it. And just to see the reaction to it when we started publicizing it just, 36 hours ago, the fans are pretty excited. I haven't heard from too many industry people, but I think the fans are excited to see, it's an important event in IndyCar history. It was obviously very polarizing at the time, and it's polarizing now. The so-called split ended 12, 13 years ago now, but at the same time, people still want to talk about it, and they want to, and I think this is the first time that someone with credibility and industry experience has really tied it all together, and put it in one volume. And hopefully it's a worthwhile read. You get involved in these projects and you get close to it and you've read that manuscript 20 times and you think, man, I just, what did I miss? What would I change? And it's time to let it go and let other people look at it.
Yeah. I'm excited because, you see a little bit here and there by people who haven't lived through it like you have, a Paul Page, someone who's been to both, you mainly did CART, but still you did at near the tail end, both CART and IRL at the time. I'm going to say the evil three letters, by the way, coined by Randy Bernard, but you saw what happened. You saw the division, and I feel like that this is the right time now to say, here's what happened, because now it people don't have those biases, I don't think, as bad as they did, back in 2008.
Well, I mean, maybe it's just a matter of there's been enough time for people to heal. Mm-hmm. Because as I say someplace in the book, I mean, that was a civil war and a divorce all mm-hmm. blended together. And it broke up friendships and sponsorships and business relationships. And it was a really tough time. I know a couple people that were partners or couples that one person worked in one series and one person worked in the other. And it was like James Carville and Mary Madeline. I couldn't imagine going home to that dinner table and either compartmentalizing or talking about it. So when it finally came together, I mean, it's been since 2008 now. The sport needs unity, and it's one of the things that I argued even toward the end. I mean, certainly toward the last couple of years of the split, I think I was as vocal as anybody saying, come on guys, you've got to get this together for the sake, before you kill it all together. I mean, they were out there with two 18 car series by 2006, and it just wasn't looking good for anybody. Clayton, run along, buddy.
We're working in news in Chicago. You see this all the time. John Oriovitz joins us on Inside Open Wheel, talks about his new book, Indy Split, coming out in May. Charlie, you and I have talked about this ad nauseum off the record, about the split. And it's something that, you know as well as I do, we needed to see this.
Yeah, I think thinking about it now and reflecting on it, I think the one good thing about the split is that it gives me a convenient excuse for why my career never got out of Pro Mazda. I can just say, well, there was no hope anyways. There was no money. All the sponsorship was gone. And there wasn't much of a future anyways. But I do have one question I'd like to ask you, John. You mentioned that this is the second split. And I remember reading another, I think probably the only other book on the split that exists. I forget what it's called exactly. But they went into it a little bit. I was wondering, how much does this book touch on the first split?
Oh, it tells the story of the first split. And to me, that's important because you can't kid yourself into thinking that the split started in 1996 or 1994 when Tony George announced the IRL. the reason that the 1996 split happened is because the 1979 split never truly got resolved. They had a brief period where they operated together in 1980 called the CRL, the Championship Racing League. But that blew up really quickly. And CART, from that point, CART took over sanctioning the series, but USAC kept sanction only of the Indianapolis 500. So they just kind of, you know, smiled and got along for 15 years or for 10 years or so, and until the Holman family handed Tony George the keys to the Speedway when he turned 30. And Tony was very aggressive about trying to regain a power base for the Speedway. You know, he clearly felt the Speedway was being disrespected in the entire equation. And perhaps they were, but the bottom line is that throughout the 80s, the CART series grew because the Indy 500 was part of it, but the Indy 500 was sustained because it was part of a growing CART series. So they needed each other, but they were unable to work together. And you have to go back and you have to tell the story of the 1979 split and why CART was formed in the first place. But beyond that, to explain, I think, and it's what I did, you have to go back to the reasons for the CART split, which were basically the rear engine revolution of the 60s. And there was this kind of cultural gap between people that wanted to keep dirt racing and all ovals as the way they operated the series. In the late 60s, USAC had brought road racing in. So there was this, the sport really stagnated in the 70s. It didn't have a lot of direction. That was the formation of CART. And what they were up against was USAC, but USAC was a product of the Holman family. Because up when Tony Holman bought the Speedway in 1945, the AAA sanctioned racing. In 1955, when Bill Vukovich was killed in Indianapolis and Alberto Ascari was killed in Italy, and of course there was the Le Mans tragedy when 80 spectators were killed, the AAA pulled out of racing and Tony Holman formed USAC. And as you know, USAC and the Speedway were hand in hand. They were essentially one unit, even though they claimed autonomy. And it was that you have to honestly, day one of the split was the day that Tony Holman bought the Speedway. Because from that moment on, that family had a power base, and it was their conflict with the competitors that led to unrest from the 70s onward.
One thing that I find interesting in the CART days was the fact that even though CART didn't sanction the 500, they still pay points out for the race.
Yeah, that was part of their deal. And, you know, USAC, they did the timing and scoring. They did the officiating. USAC was, and that was one of the flashpoints in the late 70s. They had different rules that went against each other as they tried to cope with the technology of the time. And USAC wanted to keep the old Offenhauser engine competitive. And one of the things that CART was doing, the key guys in CART, they needed to make money from the sport, and the Cosworth engine was coming in. It was good. Formula One technology was coming in, ground effects. It was getting more expensive, and outside of the Indianapolis 500, which kind of just rolled along on its own merits for decades, the rest of the sport was stagnant. And that was the key thing that they wanted. They needed a series of races that was promoted, televised, had media following, so that the series was as strong as the Indy 500. And to their credit, it got to that way. I mean, by growing the rest of the series through the 80s and up into the early 90s, you're probably too young to remember going to the races in 1993 when Nigel Mansell was over here the first year. You'd go to Road America and you know, it'd be a 1 o'clock race. There'd be 75,000 people packed around the joint. The race would end at 3. At 5:30, 6 o'clock, you're trying to leave, and there's still a line trying to get out of the track with traffic jammed up all the way to Highway 43. It was crazy, and that's why it was so frustrating that at that time you had Nigel Mansell over here and Jack Villeneuve, and the CART series was doing great, and then Tony decides, well, no, I just, you know, he felt like he had a better idea.
And we saw how that worked out from 96 on. We can go on and on about the split, but I'm really excited to read the book. Once that comes out, John, we'll get you back on. But how can fans get the Indy split, not only here in the States, but I know there's other options worldwide?
Well, the common line, I guess, is wherever books are sold. You can order it direct from Octane Press, octanepress.com. I believe if you use the code INDY20, you even get a 20% discount on it.
Oh, I wish I would have known that before.
You per value at like $27. It is available through Amazon. And as far as I know, if you're worldwide, Amazon.co.uk is offering it. And I'm sure if you individually reached out to Octane Press, they could arrange shipping to pretty much anywhere in the world if you're willing to pay the freight.
Tell you what, Charlie, May's going to be a good month for fans of IndyCar because you got John's book and you got Paul Page's book all coming out in that month.
Yeah, I think I know there's a lot of Formula One books out there. I think my shelf here is kind of full of some of them. But it's always kind of hard to find IndyCar books. So I'm really excited anytime one comes out.
Well, I should put a plug in there, therefore, for my last book, Time Flies, The History of PacWest Racing.
I have it sitting in my living room.
I need to get that too. So,
well, here it is. A very young Scott Dixon on the cover there.
No, that's Scott Dixon from yesterday.
Actually, he does look remarkably the same.
Yeah, it's scary. That guy's
a physical specimen. But you can actually go to, if you can figure out how to spell my name, John Oriovitz, Oriovicz, .com. You can buy the PacWest book there. And, you know, like I said, you get too close to a project, you can't really get a clear vision of it anymore. But I've gotten really positive feedback from this project, and it's been really gratifying. And if you are an IndyCar fan, it is a story of the kart era, and you know, it kind of sets the stage for the whole IndyCar book, which talks about, you know, the way kart just went down anyway.
Yeah. God, I'm so excited. I'll admit the day I saw it, I'm like, okay, I'm definitely buying that. I don't pre-order books normally, but that is one of the first ones I've done. So you've got me hooked, John.
Well, apparently it's selling pretty briskly. The publisher was very happy with the opening day. So it's encouraging. And, you know, I'm glad I wasn't crazy for caring about it as much as I did, because it seems like it has struck a nerve with the fan base, and they're eager to, you know, figure it out once and for all.
I don't know. I also kind of want to hear what Robin Miller's book on it too. That'd be kind of fun.
Well, Robin would have a hell of a book. And yeah. The one thing I can tell you is that Robin wrote the foreword for my book.
Ooh, so That'll be fun. Oh boy. I got to get him on sometime. All right, John Oriovitz, thanks for joining us. Indy Oreo on Twitter. We'll have you back on around May or June when the book comes out.
I expect to be around.
Sounds good. Coming up next on Inside Open Wheel, we talk about the Detroit Grand Prix from the Coca-Cola Kokomo Indy Elite Series and why we're all happy for Charlie. Next.
This is Inside Open Wheel with Jeremy Scott.
Well, we're popping champagne here on the Inside Open Wheel Studios because Charlie didn't hit anything this week. Yay!
Hooray!
Woohoo!
Jeremy, 43 laps on a street course and I didn't hit anything.
I'm proud of you. I'm really proud of you. However, not a lot of people could say that. Charlie Ante joins us here. We're going to talk about the Detroit Grand Prix at Belle Isle. And joining us is the race winner. Led the most laps and really stayed out front of trouble with a great strategy. It's Adam Blocker. Adam, congratulations. Welcome aboard.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
That was... I've got to say, I thought there that Riley Thompson had it, and then all of a sudden, you're in the lead. You know, that had to be an interesting feeling, because you guys were able to distance yourself from all the drama that was going on, you know, middle and back of the pack, and then have a good enough lead to where, you know what, just run away and hide, you know, conserve your fuel, conserve your tires.
Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of got a worse qualifying than I wanted. Right. I think I should have really been on pole if I would have put in the lap that I wanted to. But, you know, ultimately I started third, and I knew there was an option to do a one-stop or a two-stop. And I honestly wasn't worried that I was behind Riley and Adam, because I was able to keep up with them while saving fuel. And I'm pretty sure that neither one of them was saving fuel, so they were going to have to do two stops. So I think even without Riley having an incident, I probably had a really good chance to win. But then, yeah, obviously when Riley hit the wall and then Adam made his mistake on pit in, it just made it that much easier.
And you had a lot of, you know, there's a lot of interesting things. Thankfully, we didn't have a full course deal because I'm sure that would have thrown a wrench into your strategy. And we'll talk about your strategy here in a little bit, Charlie. But it had to be comforting just getting out there and just not having to worry about, you know, who's behind you, because you ended the race almost 40 seconds in the lead.
Yeah, I mean, in situations like that, that's like the best situation you want, and especially at Detroit, where, you know, Detroit's such a difficult track. I mean, you saw how many people crashed in the race and had issues. It's so bumpy, so narrow, so easy to make a really small mistake that, you know, when you have that gap to breathe, and also when I'm trying to save fuel, also, it just, you know, made for a situation where I could leave a good amount of margin and not really have to push that hard, and that's kind of what you want at Detroit, so...
Yeah, Charlie, had to feel comforting, though, knowing that, you know, you just had to stay out of trouble, because it seemed like, you know, from the word go, you had people just hitting walls, spinning out, hitting each other, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, Detroit is always going to be a race of attrition. I wasn't expecting quite as much because, you know, most of the people in this series are better than your average public IndyCar race on iRacing. So I wasn't expecting it to be as bad as usual, but my strategy was just to find a gap in front and behind and just stay out of the walls and pick up spots as people dropped out.
And in blockers, we said your winner, Brian Carey, second, Andreas Eich, third. We'll talk more about him in just a little bit. David Adams, fourth, Henry Bennett, fifth, Adam Crane, Riley Thompson, Ray Kingsbury, Marshall Stanley, and Charlie. And rounding out your top 10, it's got to feel good to hear your best finish 10th place.
Hey, my best career finish.
I've got to say, though, near the end of the race, you had a good battle between you, Kingsbury, and Stanley. What happened there? Was it just your setup was not up to par to keep up with them?
Well, I think it ultimately ended because I had to go in the pit.
Well, yeah, there was that. But before that, I think a lap or two before
you. No, I think Kingsbury is just faster than me. I think I got in front of him on pit stops, and that's why I was in front of him, not really because of pace.
So here are some of the names that were out of the race. Obviously, Matt Kingsbury, he didn't even run a lap. Joe Branch, two laps out. He was out within two laps. Matt Hollibaugh, John Downing, Andrew Kinsella, Chris DeMeritt. He's had nothing but problems on road courses. And Charlie, I joked afterwards, I'm thinking that you should teach Chris how to drive around a road course, and he should teach you how to use the weight jacker.
Yeah, I mean, on road courses, I know what I'm doing. I think when people say that, there's kind of an implication that they're good at it, which is not the case here. But I do know how to drive a race car on a road course.
Well, you've run it internationally, and we've seen we've seen viral videos of you knowing how to drive a road course. By the way, Adam, you've seen the crash, the Star Mazda crash from Montreal, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
And you know that that's from his video, right?
Yeah, I didn't realize that until he started running with us and somebody said that that's the guy from the video. But yeah.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember it first came out. It's like, oh, that sucked. And then, you know, we became fast friends. And he's like, oh, by the way, that's me. I'm like, whoa. So.
Yeah, if only YouTube were bigger back then.
Yeah, no, exactly. You'd be rolling in the dough. Alex Ball, Andrew Wood. That was a surprise to see Wood out. But he had so many problems. Did he say what happened during the race? That, you know, he crashed into the wall. We know that. But did he talk about his problems, Charlie?
I think he did, but I forget exactly what he said.
Boy, your girlfriend must really love you then, because you forget what she says too, I bet.
Well, yeah, I mean, without Siri, I don't know what I would
do. Yeah, Flynn Lazier also kind of surprising that he had some issues. Matt Pawlewski also, Trevor Greenfield. So, wasn't it Trevor? There was one driver, I can't remember who it was, stayed clean the whole race, Grant's finished several laps down, but he still finished. I thought that was fantastic strategy.
I think it was Tanner Watkins.
Tanner Watkins, thank you. Yeah, that was a phenomenal strategy by Watkins. It netted him a 12th place finish. So, I mean, with all the attrition, that was fantastic to see him up there. Adam, we take a look at the standings also. Andreas Eich, Philip Krause, Kristen Merritt, Ray Kingsbury, Henry Bennett. Your win moves you up 3 to 6th place. You've only run 4 races, so you're the best out of the 4. So that's not too bad. 10 bonus points so far in the season.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've had a shot to win. I mean, my finishes are 2 seconds and a 7th, and the race I finished 7th, I led the most laps. So definitely been, up there in contention every time. It's just kind of things didn't fall my way on some of the ovals. But the main problem I'm going to have going for points is that, I'm probably going to have to miss a couple more races just because of real life commitments in the IndyCar paddock. So, yeah. That's going to make it tough, but all I can do is run the races I can run and finish as well as I can and hope that either myself or one of my teammates can win the championship. That's kind of the goal.
Now, can you come out and say what you do in the IndyCar paddock?
Yeah, I'm a trackside engineer for Ilmor, Ilmor does the engines for Chevy, if you guys don't know.
Yeah, that's an awesome job, because I actually know a guy who used to work in the IndyCar paddock for Dallara. Now he's in the IMSA paddock. And it's amazing that how many people don't realize that, you have the crew members, but there's still a ton of support staff that follow the series from race to race.
Yeah, I mean, just, beyond the teams that each team will bring, quite a few, at least the big teams bring quite a few engineers and mechanics. But then obviously there's all the supporting suppliers like X-Track brings guys for the drivetrain and gearboxes, and obviously Chevy and Honda. And, Dallara, it goes on down the line. Cosworth for electronics, just keeps going. And there's like a huge, your paddock outside of just the teams as well.
Now, on a normal race weekend, how big is the staff of Chevy Ilmor?
So for the people we bring to a race weekend, obviously there's a lot more people at the shop that do a lot of the fabrication and assembly and all that stuff. But just for the people that come to the race weekend, there's like 3 people in upper management that normally come. And then there's basically 12 engineers sort of in a similar, like myself included, that are basically assigned to cars individually. And we basically look after the calibrations on a particular car for that weekend. So we're basically like calibration engineers assigned to one car.
Okay, so that's not too bad. All right, let's talk about Chicagoland Speedway. That is my hometown real-life oval track. Sad to see it go by the wayside, but Charlie, you're going to see what you're going to get up close to the wall. I'm not going to talk about that. Adam, have you had a chance to sit down and get on the racetrack and kind of test it out?
I haven't done much testing for this upcoming race, but obviously I've run it before, and I think it's, unless things change between now and the weekend, I know iRacing has been doing a lot of updates to fix different things, but I have a feeling that it's going to be pretty packed together, and there's not going to be a lot of field separation, which honestly I don't really like normally. Like, I kind of like the either, short ovals or road courses, and also the big ovals where things kind of get spread out and driver skill really matters a lot. And yeah, I'm not sure exactly how Chicagoland is going to go, but like I said, I haven't had a lot of testing, but we kind of had a similar race at Texas though, and it ended up being pretty good. We had a lot of green running, so I'm sure the elite guys can make a good race out of it, even if the package isn't ideal.
And Charlie, that's a track that even in the IRL days, we kind of joked it's a stomp and steer track, which is, obviously you keep the foot to the throttle and you just turn. So
The way that Adam's describing it, it looks like I'm probably going to have an EOL penalty at Richmond.
Yeah.
so we'll see. I'll do some work with the weight jacker and hope that it
Well, let's talk about that too, because you've had a chance to drive Chicagoland, correct?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, is it still that stomp and steer that we've talked about, or is it, you got a left off because it's a different package from when the last time the real Indy cars were there?
I'm sure it's stomp and steer with no traffic, but I haven't driven it recently enough with other cars. And it depends on the setup too. I'm sure a competitive setup, you're probably trimmed out as much as you can. So I don't know. We'll just have to see.
Well, you've always got a bed to sleep in. Oh wait, no, never mind. You're racing from home anyway. But nonetheless, it's interesting to see it's going to be interesting to see what happens, because Chicagoland, always one of my favorite events on the schedule. And as we go, that is the SimTV 225. So the TV's partnership is funding this weekend's race. And really, it's a stretch of three in a row, because we just got done with Detroit, and now we're at Chicagoland. And Adam, as you said, now we're going to the short track at Richmond, which is another one of my favorite tracks. But then you get right into the heat of the Indianapolis 500.
Yeah, definitely. I kind of look forward to Richmond. Always, it's kind of a unique track for the IndyCar. It's really tight, but you know, it's makes for some really fun racing and really difficult to deal with lap traffic and stuff. But yeah, definitely all the teams are already preparing for the Indy 500, not only in May, the main iRacing Indy 500, but also the Elite 500. It's so much work that goes into being competitive at Indy, and I know, like, my team, Powerslide, we've already started our preparations, and I'm sure Team Talon and i5G and all the other big teams have already started their preparations too.
Well, has Talent started, Charlie?
Oh, yeah. I don't think it ever really stops, to be honest.
Yeah, it sounds like real life racing. All right, the SimTV 225. That's Sunday at 7 Eastern on YouTube. Adam, thanks for joining us. Good luck, and I'm sure you and I will cross paths in the IndyCar paddock at some point this year.
Yep, you'll have to say hi when we do. And thanks for having me on. And good luck next week, Charlie.
Thank you. You too.
And we're going to continue with the sim racing theme. Coming up next, we review the IndyCar Challenge at Montreal. Stay tuned.
This is Inside Open Wheel with Jeremy Scott.
And we're talking about more iRacing. The IndyCar iRacing Invitational just ended not too long ago. Charlie, you had a chance to watch it because some of us actually had some adult duties to take care of. How close was it to the iRacing Challenge of last year?
I was just thinking right before we went to air that it kind of felt like a throwback to last year.
Okay.
To the lockdown. It felt very similar. I think Alex Palou just walked away from everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
The commentators, Jake Query and Kate, I forget her last name.
She's going by Hargett? No, she's going by Katie Kyle, I believe.
I think that they missed some things, especially an incident on the first lap. And
to their credit, they're both capable broadcasters, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you're not used to doing, calling iRacing races, it's easy to miss something. It's not like, my understanding is it's not like a real race broadcast where you have, you know, like a huge monitor with several different cameras where you can see incidents happening. You just have the one broadcast feed per se. So, I mean, I could see that happening.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective that I hadn't thought about. That you can only sort of see one screen as opposed to many. I'll cut them some slack. And I think that there is, we saw it last year that, you know, since it's a quote unquote video game that people sort of tend to take it a little bit less seriously.
Yeah.
Not to say that anybody is unprofessional, but, you know, they're not sort of warming up to it and like get your game face on and the lights come on and we go. It's just kind of like, yeah, this is fun. We're messing around. The commentary, I should say, had a very informal feeling to it, to put it that way.
So your podium looked like this. Alex Palou, the winner, and I would not be surprised if we see him on the top step of the podium sometime this season. Second place goes to the Indy Pro 2000 championship runner, Braden Eaves, in the number 17 Road to Indy, the Lara Team Penske rookie Scott McLaughlin, once again proved his worth in iRacing as he finished third in his PPG Chevrolet. I want that diecast, by the way. That is a slick paint scheme.
I can't wait for the road course diecast to come out.
Oh, that's gonna be
I'm
so
gonna
much
buy
fun.
As many of those as I can.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I might do the same myself. I actually have a Daytona prototype. Hold on a second. I'm probably gonna. There we go. I actually have a Daytona prototype diecast coming my way. It's that of Elliot Forbes Robinson.
Ooh, What year is it?
It's the first gen, the Crawford.
Ooh, the Proto Turtles.
But the Crawford, I think, looks like a GTP.
Let me take it.
So let me see here. See what we could. There we go. Okay, so I finally got the running order up. Alex Pelot, your winner. Ray Neve, second. Scott McLaughlin, third. James Davison, up to fourth. Sage Kerman, the 98, fifth. Pietro Fittipaldi, sixth in the 52. R.C. Enerson, seventh in the 75. Eighth, Takuma Sato, ninth. Marcus Ericsson, 10th. Nikita Lastashkin in the 21. As we look further back in the field. Come on. Ed Jones, 11th, Will Power, 12th, Romain Grosjean, 13th, Max Chilton, 14th, Dalton Kellett, 15th, Simon Sykes was a late addition because of some previous commitments that Connor Daly had to make. So Simon Sykes is in the 20. He finishes lap down in 16th, 17th to Joseph Newgarden, Charlie Kimball in 18th. Looks like he didn't get that well of a start. Next week, the field goes off to Homestead, Miami. I think they're going to announce the Bathurst list fan vote. I have a feeling though that that's going to go to Sebring. I just have a feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking they should go to Oxford Plains, which is my absolute least favorite track on iRacing.
Ooh, Oxford Plains. I wish that they put Castle Combe on iRacing.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
I think you would have a blast with that. There's something that you and I were going back and forth during the race while I was doing my adult duties, which, by the way, my wife actually kind of peered in and made sure I wasn't doing anything I should have been doing, jokingly enough. You said, I know we have some Indy Elite drivers and officials who listen to this show, so I think we would get some pull on this. But you said that it would be an interesting race to have the real life IndyCar drivers go against the Indy Elite IndyCar drivers.
Yes, I do think that would be a very interesting matchup, because I sort of see our series as kind of like, you know, to borrow a term, the elite. I mean, the top IndyCar iRacing drivers in the world are in the series. Certainly, I'm not one of them, which is why I'm always in the back. But the ones that are at the front certainly are. And so I think it would be really interesting to see how they match up against the real world drivers, because it's kind of like, I mean, when the IndyCar drivers come onto iRacing, it's like they're in our wheelhouse. Like, this is our home. And so we, or I should say the, you know, the people in the championship are more intimately familiar with the intricacies of iRacing rather than the real world. And I think that could be a fairly significant advantage.
Well, not to mention, any time that they're in iRacing, I believe... Was this a fixed setup? I can't remember. I thought I heard something that wasn't going to be a fixed setup. I think that... Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the Indy Elite Series, this Indy Elite Series, is the only open setup regular series. Everybody else is all fixed.
Yeah, I believe so. And I guess that would be another, like, if they do it, would it be a fixed series or would it be an open series? I guess it would have to be fixed, because I mean, you can't just take you can't, even if without, you know, the classified stuff and everything. But if you took a Penske setup sheet and tried to plug it into the iRacing car, it would probably be horrible, because there are small differences and they add up. So you can't just copy and paste a real world setup into iRacing and expect it to be any good. You have to work the same processes that you do in the real world with testing and looking at data and all that stuff. But the actual numbers themselves are probably going to be different.
Yeah, I would. I think a fixed setup would probably work about the best. Yeah, because I was thinking about that. I'm like, no. Let them do open. Let them figure out on their own. But it's like, why? Because then I think there should be a fixed setup. So,
yeah, I think with the experience that the Indy Elite drivers and teams have with the setup stuff, I think they would wipe the floor with the real world drivers.
Oh yeah.
That.
Okay, so I'm proposing this, all right? At the end of this Indy Elite season, so take a look at the schedule. That would be after October 19th, so sometime in November. Mm-hmm. A triple crown of all-star races. You take the top, I'd say cut it off at 20. No.
Ooh, you're raising the stakes for me now.
We're going to do the top 23 Indy Elite drivers. Oh, wait, hold on. Let me think about this for a second. I'm doing this off the top of my head. Okay, so there are 18 cars. Because you got to have 33 cars in the Indy Elite Series. That's just, you know. 27-8. There we go. Done. Or 25-8.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's the point where people just stop listening. And I understand that. No. But in all seriousness. I got to think about this because you've got to have some sort of cutoff for an all-star series. Anyway, invite as many.
I would just say take top 10 and top 10, make a 20 car grid.
I like it.
So top 10 of the Indy Elite and top 10 of the real world IndyCar drivers.
I like it. Yeah. Or 10 IndyCar drivers who want to participate.
Yeah. Right, you can do that.
Okay, so you take 10 IndyCar drivers, top 10 Indy Elite drivers, and then maybe have a wild card of both.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then that qualifies for a 3-race shootout. So you have it at, you do Long Beach, Indy, and Richmond. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think that would be great. I mean, you got a street circuit, you got the two biggest races in the IndyCar season,
yeah.
And then you've got, one of them is a speedway, one of them is a street circuit, and then a short oval. So
yeah.
You've kind of got all the bases covered.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Or if we really want to do a fancy track, we do the short oval as New Hampshire.
Or we could just go full fantasy and go to the iRacing Speedway.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's like the Coca-Cola Speedway. I was thinking...
It is the Coca-Cola Speedway.
It is, yeah. Yeah, because I was thinking, oh, you do Coca-Cola Speedway, and I forgot that iRacing has that there.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And you know what's also cool? So the whole deal with that is that when the stock cars go there, they take off the restrictor plates.
Oh, my.
When the Indy cars go there, they use the road course power setting.
Oh.
So yeah, you're gonna be hitting like what, 250, 260?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, because I don't think you're letting off either because they're big sweepers.
Yeah, they're gigantic.
Yeah, I remember racing that speedway on NASCAR Racing 03. So,
mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, it's fun to go there in virtual reality. You just get a sense of how big everything is.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, you're not wrong. But that about wraps up for this week anyway. Charlie, next week's going to be a busy show. It's the F4 FR America's OPA season preview, I should say. We'll talk to some drivers. One driver we know we have shirt up right now is Spencer Bucknum. He is the 2020 F4 Western champion. He moves up to the national championship this year, and we'll talk to him. He's running with Kiwi Motorsport. Of course, we're going to have several other surprises throughout the show as well. So for John Uriovitz, Miles Rowe, I should say, and for my driver analyst, Charlie Ante, as well as last week's winner in the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Kokomo Indy Elite Series, Adam Blocker, I'm Jeremy Scott. We thank you for listening. Don't forget, it's another race weekend for the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Kokomo Indy Elite Series. It's a SimTV 225 at my hometown track, the Chicagoland Speedway, 150 laps, around the 1.5 miles oval. Going to be Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern on YouTube. Inside Open Wheel is a production of Trackout Multimedia.